This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This program is brought to you by...
It's time for confidence. It's time for mobility. It's time for Petrolius. Try Petrolius today and gain the personal sense of freedom that will allow you to take on and conquer the world. Side effects may include but are not limited to nausea, anxiety, and inflated sense of confidence, hostility, rage, migraine, headaches, personal distress, financial distress, family distress, fuzzy thinking, fuzzy math, fuzzy dice, asthma, coughing, lung cancer, skin lesions, air pollution, water pollution, smog, soot, human rights disasters, global warming, forest destruction, unemployment, and public outrage. Petrolius is also highly addictive and can cause tunnel vision, greed, irritability, deception, distortion, distraction, corruption, extreme paranoia, terrorism, aggressiveness, and irrational behavior. May even cause death.
Every day brings new shocks and horrors. Did you miss this one? The atmosphere is changing faster, much faster than ever before. The prime greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, increased by 25% in 2024 over the previous record set in 2023. That's a big jump and it's unexpected. It means faster ice loss, sea level rise, record heat, and more extreme weather. We've been seeing lots of that. In two words, climate change. Yes, fossil fuel emissions also set new records last year, but nowhere near enough to explain this new burst of carbon in the air. New science reveals the cause. Natural systems are soaking up our excess carbon, but they are declining on both sea and land. This frightening development takes us closer to a series of climate emergencies, no matter what other human stories fill our minds. We explore declining carbon capture by plants with a world-recognized expert, Dr. Pep Canadell, Chief Research Scientist for CISRO in Australia and Executive Director of the Global Carbon Project.
Radio EcoShock.
I know, the world seems to be on fire right now with a one-man tornado who can pay attention to anything. But suppose, in this riveting human drama, the natural world goes bad. Suppose there was a way to measure that, to really know about changes that affect our lives. That would be science. But even there, we can discover some wrong assumptions and strange new truths. For climate change, the root is carbon dioxide. But understanding global carbon is not easy. Fortunately, we have as our guide a world-recognized scientist. Dr. Josep Canadell is Executive Director of the Global Carbon Project and Chief Research Scientist at Australia's premier research institute, CSIRO. Known to all as PEP, Dr. Canadell is author of more than 240 peer-reviewed science papers. From Canberra, Australia, Pep Canadell, welcome back to Radio EcoShock. So you have a perspective article in the latest issue of Science. It's called Looking Beyond the Trees for Carbon Storage, and that accompanies a new study from Yinon M. Baron from the California Institute of Technology. And his new paper, it's titled Recent Gains in Global Terrestrial Carbon Stocks are mostly stored in non-living pools. Well, that doesn't sound very exciting, but it provides new visions of where carbon is stored, and that really matters. What drew you to this paper?
I think that this paper kind of brings a big surprise insofar that we have always thought that the extra carbon accumulated by vegetation due to the increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide is accumulated largely in what we call living biomass, that the trees are bigger, the trunks are bigger, that there's more roots, and ultimately also more litter and soil organic matter. And what the authors find is that the place where the least amount of carbon is accumulated is actually in the actual biomass, the trunks, the trees, the leaves. And instead, carbon flows through this vegetation very quickly into litter and into the soils. And from there, either accumulating in the soils or being, you know, washed off into the inland waters, where, you know, all the lakes and rivers and ponds, everything that, you know, there's fresh water gets accumulated. And also they make the point that, of course, we take a lot of this biomass and we use it. We use it for wood construction of houses. We also put a lot of these woody materials ultimately into landfills. So basically, when they count everything, they find that only a few percentages of the total carbon sink that gets accumulated elsewhere, somewhere in the biosphere, stays in the living biomass, and the rest kind of goes into all these other pools, which we thought before were less important.
You know, even with your article and the paper, I was still a little lost until I took myself back to school to learn the basics. Carbon can be in the air, like carbon dioxide. It can be in the sea, but there is carbon, a lot of it, stored under our feet. Please tell us about the different forms of carbon found in the soil and why they matter.
Yeah, the soil carbon is a huge reservoir of carbon for various reasons. But one is that, you know, we have all the living biomass eventually dies and decomposes. And we have what we call organic carbon, which kind of stays in the soil. And then there's another fractions, which are called inorganic carbon. But then we have all the, what we call the very organic soils, the peats, you know, the big forests in Indonesia, in Congo, the wetlands, which have huge amounts of stored organic carbon. It's dead carbon already, but it still remains as organic. And when we look at how much there is in all these places, we have many times more carbon stored in the soil, what we call in the permafrost, you know, frozen organic soils of the northern latitudes, Canada, Russia. We have, you know, several times more than the accumulated carbon in the atmosphere. So the atmosphere has about a little more than 800 billion tons of carbon. And in the soils and organic soils and peatlands and permafrost, you know, we have at least three times that quantity stored there.
In your perspective in science, you also point out wildfires released unprecedented surges of CO2 emissions in Siberia in 2021 and in Canada in 2023. Do you think those events can accelerate climate change?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. So we have many different types of fires around the world. Think for a second, Australian fires, 2019, we had humongous, unprecedented amount of forest fires. But our vegetation in Australia is actually highly adapted to fire. And those forests have recovered literally in a matter of very few years, almost to the point they were before the fires. Now, this thing might not go forever, but that's what's happening now. Now, go to what we call the boreal forest in Canada, in Siberia, where when you burn a forest, it takes literally many decades to more than 100 years to bring all that carbon back. The reasons being twofold. First is because a lot of those trees, species, are not adapted to fire necessarily, and they may not have the kind of resprouting capacity that other species around the world might have, number one. And number two, the soils, which often are very organic, has a lot of organic matter. And when you burn that organic matter, you're burning dozens of years of accumulation of carbon that is going to take those dozens of years up to more than 100 years to accumulate again once the forest gets reestablished. So that huge imbalance means carbon will remain in the atmosphere for a long time and will increase the overall carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and therefore the warming impact of that carbon dioxide.
And there's a lot of life under the ground. I mean, there's 60 billion tiny worms, the nematodes, for every human on the planet. My question is, if the living plants are less important, perhaps, than the organic carbon in the soil, here's what we really need to know. Has microbic life that breaks down carbon in the soil and releases it, has it increased with warming, thus speeding up the release of that carbon? Do we know?
We don't. We know that there's a lot of carbon on microbial organisms, a lot, but we don't know it as well as being able to track any changes over time as we could and as we can, let's say for Abu Ghraib biomass, which we now have satellites, as in the study we're discussing, satellites that they can track those changes annually, sometimes even monthly. So we don't have that capacity to do it. Now, all these organisms are important and they're all impacted by climate change. And of course, microbial communities are heavily impacted by changes in rainfall, which means soil moisture. Of course, wetter, more moist soils are better for these microbial flora to excel. And also temperature. They all work better when the soils are warmer. And the one thing that we know for sure that's happening with climate change is that both air and soils and oceans are all warming up.
And the balance of carbon going into or out of our soil seems to have changed since the 1990s. Global plant capture goes up and down. How would you explain that?
Yeah, so plants are, we're talking about the you know, how much carbon is absorbed by plants. The ocean also absorbs carbon dioxide, but you know, the studies about plants and particularly woody plants, mostly forests. And these forest species are, of course, very sensitive to weather and climate changes. And so what we find is that when we have some of these events, global climatic events, let's say what we call the Southern Oscillation, the El Niño and La Niña. During El Niño years, globally, the mean temperature is actually warmer than the average. And when we have La Niñas, again, these are almost global phenomena, the global mean temperature is cooler than the average. And so every time that there's one of these phenomena, plants react to it. And so when there is a warmer world during an El Niño, plants take up less carbon dioxide. And we have actually measured and estimated and studied this thing very well. The same way, when we have a La Niña, we have more carbon dioxide being uptaken by the plants, which is a good thing. The problem is that as we move into the future in a global warming world, we know the direction of the efficiency of these carbon sinks, which is to become less efficient because we know that they operate less well under warmer conditions. So that's not a good outcome, or that's not a good outlook for us. As nature, as we move into the future, will bring less support to what it is now about the removal of about half of all CO2 emissions from human activities. That is, every year we put about 11 billion tons of carbon from human activities, from combustion of fossil fuels to deforestation. And about half of these 11 billion tons are absorbed by plants, vegetation, and the ocean. So what I'm trying to get here to is that as we move into the future, this fraction of, you know, 50% of all CO2 being removed will diminish. So we have now like a 50% discount of climate change thanks to nature. So this nature in the future will help us a little less, which is a very compelling rationale for us to act as quickly and as fast as we can, because it is now that we have this, you know, very high level of support from nature to kind of slow down the buildup of CO2 and therefore warming.
Is there a bit of good news in this new way of understanding carbon in the soil from this study?
Yes. So by having more carbon accumulated from these carbon sinks that we're discussing, accumulated in outside of vegetation, it means that what has been a store perhaps is a little more stable than what we thought before, because now, you know, that carbon store, you know, it's not in the vegetation, it's not in the leaves, it's not in the branches, it's not in the trunk. So if these were to burn, of course, we're losing a lot of carbon, but we have a lot of this carbon that is stored under lakes, being pushed down to the coastal areas and buried in sediments. We have them also in human reservoirs, in landfills, for good or for bad, and in our ever-building and expanding urban world with, you know, more wood requirements for, you know, from furniture to actually building the actual houses. So, I mean, that's a good part of, you know, this new study, but nevertheless, carbon has to go through vegetation first before it gets accumulated in all these other stores. And of course, that process, it's still susceptible to droughts and extreme warming and heat, extreme heats and fire. And, you know, we see also the growth in many parts of temperate to boreal regions of more insect damage because the winters are warmer than they used to be. So, I mean, these things are still vulnerable. The process is still vulnerable to all these processes. But what has accumulated already is perhaps a little more stable than what we thought. And that's a good thing.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and with us is Dr. Pep Cannadel, Chief Research Scientist at CISRO. And we are learning there is much more carbon stored in the soil than in the plants above. Back in 2011, I interviewed a Vermont carbon farmer, Abe Collins. He was part of the Soil Carbon Challenge, along with Peter Donovan. They attempted to get carbon farming recognized in the New England Carbon Trading Scheme at the time, and then it seemed like tree planting became a more popular solution. With this new study, were these carbon farming folks onto something?
Yeah, so let me just maybe begin by saying that the biggest issue of soil carbon, and in this case of your example, above ground tree carbon, is what we call the verification. It is relatively easy for us to have a project and go and measure how much carbon we have in the trees. We can go there and measure the diameters of the trunks and the height of the trees. And we can see this thing over time, how it changes. So now if we have bigger projects, we have even satellites that begin to measure these things and every time are more reliable. When we go to the soils, we can do good measures of carbon in the soil. We do, actually, the techniques are very well established, but it is a little harder for us to measure how that pool that had carbon in the soil changes over time. And the reason is that there's so much carbon in the soil that, of course, changes are going to be obviously very small and therefore difficult to detect. And that's why a lot of programs have basically either ignore the soil or just not go there at all. And some, they just stayed with, you know, trees that people feel that they can see and they can measure whether they're there or they're not, whether they're growing or they're not growing, or whether they're burning. So that's the main reason. Now, are we onto something new because this study? Well, the study emphasized that, you know, ultimately a more important reservoir of this new carbon entering into the system is the soil than the actual trees and trunks. And maybe we'll give a bit of an impetus. The verification and measurement thing remains an issue, but there's new technologies as well. There's more kind of a spectroscopy technologies that are making it a little easier to measure hundreds to thousands of samples of soil for carbon. And maybe some of these technologies will help to give the confidence to investors and people running these programs or trying to establish these programs to include soil carbon.
I'm sure you recall the conference 4 degrees or More, Australia in a Hot World, back in 2011. And when you and I talked in 2018, we dared to ask, is even 2 degrees C of warming just a dream now? And just recently, the government of France announced they were planning adaptation for 4 degrees C of warming. Is it just me, or is it madness to think that this civilization would survive well in a world that is 4 degrees hotter global mean temperature?
Well, I think that is madness to think that we would survive. There'll be survival, of course, but things will be very, very different. I must say that with everything that is happening, for good and for bad, we don't think that we're moving into a 4-degree world. I mean, a 4-degree world, as it has been modeled by these scenarios that we develop in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, they rely on a future all the way to 2100, where almost the entire economy will be based on coal energy. So the coal would be gasified to produce gas, it would be liquefied to produce liquid fuels that we need for cars. It would be everything. And clearly, we're not going so incredibly dirty anymore. If anything, coal power plants are clearly, you know, to begin with, not financially competitive with any other of the current technologies. And we see a huge slowdown. And in countries like, of course, the US, many parts of Europe, including Australia as well, we have huge, very rapidly closure of coal power plants. So I don't think we're going to this 4-degree world. Now, have we missed even the opportunity to stay under 2 degrees? Well, that's up in the air. I don't think that we know. A lot of people are confident that we still can do it. And I think that we can still do it, but certainly we cannot be sleeping on the wheel, as it seems we are doing, you know, sometimes going back and forth. In case here is, of course, the US at this point. But, you know, we really have to actually become much more aggressive on a path now that we understand very well, where, you know, coal, you know, almost disappears completely. Gas plays a role that it's highly debated. You know, we try to electrify the economy, you know, almost as much as we can, and things that we had not even thought they were possible. Now we know that they're possible. And of course, if we can produce that electricity with renewable, low carbon energies, then we are in the path. But that aggressiveness that we need to push this process, it's not there yet. And 2 degrees can very quickly, you know, slip off our hands as well.
I do notice that at the Mauna Loa Observatory in 2024, CO2 increased by 3.58 parts per million in the air. And that's the biggest jump ever recorded. It's something like 25% higher than 2023. The EU's Copernicus system reports a lower number, an increase of 2.9 parts per million in 2024. Either way, carbon is climbing faster than ever. Your group at the Global Carbon Project has to take all this in kind of on the run. What does the acceleration, if there is one, mean for a carbon budget for governments?
Yeah, so first of all, it's very difficult to say whether it's an acceleration because, you know, the Earth system is a very complex system. It has all these variability, and we try not to make our statements out of a few years' data. Having said that, you know, we might be waiting for something to be confirmed from a science point of view and then be way too late to do anything about it. So I think we need to be really on top of these annual updates. Yes, 2024 was extraordinary. 2023 was also quite extraordinary. And not only Mauna Loa and Copernicus, here in Australia, we also measure, you know, atmospheric CO2, and we saw a huge jump as well. Now, what it means that the natural CO2 sinks, the very things we were talking about a second ago on the vegetation, the forests, you know, the grasslands of the world. And in this case, also, I need to bring the oceans, because warmer oceans are less efficient at, you know, absorbing CO2. It means that they're working less well. The efficiency of these natural CO2 sinks, which I said before, they are removing 50% of all our emissions. Our emissions means active, you know, from human activities, combustion of fossil fuels and deforestation, you know, will become less and less uptake, and therefore more and more carbon left into the atmosphere. Therefore, faster warming and what we call the remaining carbon budget, which is your question, of course, shrinks even faster than the emissions that humans are putting into it, because now we have this ally that we had before, nature, helping us a little less. And that's what exactly we're seeing in 2024 with a big spike of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, which does not mean that we emitted, humans emitted much more carbon dioxide. No, we did not. We continue to emit huge amounts, 10 billion tons of carbon, which is an insane amount of carbon, but it is the natural sinks that they did less good, they did less well, and therefore the total amount of our emissions that stayed in the atmosphere were much, much higher. In this case, a record, you know, in the observatory record that we have.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Australia's David Karoly, And we discussed the wanton destruction of American science and whether the rest of the world could step up to keep the essential climate research going. With your role at CISRO and the Global Carbon Project, Pep, you are part of that rest of the world, in my mind. What are the challenges for climate science now?
Well, first of all, we need to kind of wait and see what's happening. Well, wait and see. We need to make a bigger investment ourselves, the rest of the world, as you put it. But we need to wait and see, you know, whether we're truly looking at the discontinuation of some of the observations and big data sets and long-term data sets that NOAA and NASA, you know, are responsible for. They could come to a termination, and it would have, you know, really important impacts. The contribution of global networks from NOAA and NASA are disproportionately large, so, which means that if any of those data sets and observations were to stop, we would have a huge hole, which would take us many, many years to try to fill. And of course, we would lose, you know, the continuity, which is one of the most important things, to continue with a historical period so we can analyze very carefully, you know, the changes into present and then, you know, what's to come in the future. We're waiting and see, just to see what the ultimate impact is above and beyond, and many people losing important positions of research positions and observatory positions in these agencies. We're all very concerned about the near future.
Pep Cannadale, you have big desks in Australian research and global carbon. What are your priorities coming up?
Well, we're trying to put a lot of emphasis on other gases. We focus on methane and nitrous oxide. Methane maybe has had a bit of a more of an interest as before. It was kind of almost a secondary gas. Methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas. We have an opportunity to really try to lower, you know, what we call the peak warming. One thing is stabilizing the climate, which we need zero emissions from carbon dioxide. But the other thing is that at which peak we're stabilizing warming. And methane can play a very important role at really bringing that peak down so that we can truly avoid 2 degrees and kind of bring the overall effort with CO2 more under control. Nitrous oxide comes mostly from cropping using nitrogen fertilizers, chemical fertilizers. Of course, we use millions and millions of tons of these every year to produce food. It's a very difficult place to go because this is food security. You know, we try to keep it, you know, as a top priority of every single country, but it is an important contributor. It's the third most important gas, nitrous oxide. And so we try to also emphasize a little more what the opportunities are to bring those emissions down. And finally, we're continue to be very focused on, you know, trying to develop very sophisticated, complex, what we call full comprehensive budgets of greenhouse gases at the regional and national level, so that we can actually support governments and actors in each country around the world to understand where the sources, where the sinks, which are natural, which are anthropogenic, which are changing because human behavior, which ones are changing because we're changing the climate itself. And that kind of feeds back into some of those natural sources and sinks of greenhouse gases. So we can have a very comprehensive picture, and that can help to plan a little better, you know, the actions for rapid mitigation.
Well, as we end our time together, I want to say that many of our listeners are really worried about climate change. This comes out in polls. It comes out in a lot of ways. Is there anything else you would like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I think that the response to climate change, which is basically decarbonizing, it is actually something very desirable. I mean, one could argue that you want to decarbonize even if there is no climate change, because what we're trying to do is to move away from highly polluting energies. Coal is incredibly polluting. It's responsible for thousands of premature deaths every year. We have natural gas even in our houses, inside of our houses, and we know that. There's nitrous oxides, there's other organic particulate components that come from that combustion, even on our stoves, which are, you know, from a health point of view, or something that we don't want, and we have even inside of our house, we're trying to develop much more sophisticated, you know, modes of transportation. Certainly, if anyone has ever driven an electric car, I doubt that we'll ever go back to an internal combustion car, because it's such something much more sophisticated. At the same time, it's much easier to produce, to run, much more efficient in terms of the use of the energy. Internal combustion cars, they you know, waste at least half of the energy embedded into the gasoline we're using. So in a way, we're trying to create a little, I would call it a better world. There's no doubt about it. Renewable energy can be domestically grown. So we don't have to have all these big geopolitical, you know, mess that we had for many decades. So, you know, one thing after the other that we need to do for a rapid decarbonization are things that, as I said, we probably want to have anyway. So it's a win-win. That's what I'm trying to say. And therefore, really worth pushing as hard as we can. And now, more than ever before, we actually know mostly how to do, maybe not 100% everything we need to do, but probably 90% of what we need to do to decarbonize that economy, the energy systems. Something that we didn't know, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we were still discussing, are cars going to be fueled by biofuels? Are they going to be fueled by hydrogen? Are they going to be electric? And now it clearly, you know, electric is what it seems clear the choice, an economic choice, which is reasonable. We know how to do it. We can deploy it fast. You know, hydrogen might play some role. Biofuels might play some role, but these are all secondary roles. These things we did not know clearly, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So it's exciting to see how the path to decarbonization, to low carbon emissions, is coming very clear, very quickly.
From Australia's capital, Canberra, we've been speaking with Dr. Pep Cannadale. You can find links to his new article, Looking Beyond the Trees for Carbon Storage, and the new study on global carbon stocks, all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Pep, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We've tipped, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's over.
The new Trump administration dumped Pentagon plans for climate change. It's all a hoax, they said. But climate is a national security threat. Denial is also a national security threat. In these days, when car vandals are being labeled terrorists, computer guru and security expert Richard Power, advisor to top corporations, says global warming is a threat far more serious than terrorism. We dive back into a critical conversation with Richard, recorded in 2007. It is spooky how much this interview speaks to us today. Whether the new fear is autonomous killer drones or city-busting nuclear suitcases, the real mega threat to humanity and all life in this epoch is climate change. Here, Richard explains his journey from cybersecurity threat analyst for major corporations to climate realist. Richard did advise major corporations, and he appeared on TV networks and mainstream news like the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal. This interview from Radio EcoShock, September 21st, 2007. It speaks to us now. Try it. You'll see. So little has changed for those of us who peer into the future. While mainstream media feeds us fallen Republicans and Hollywood stars, this has been an earth-shaking summer for global warming. I'm not talking about the new heat records set all over the U.S., or the snap floods in the Midwest or even Britain, or even the record giant hurricanes. Our next guest's latest blog points with alarm to the sudden meltdown in the Arctic. And Richard Power is not your average green warrior. He's an acknowledged expert on cybersecurity and world security threats.
author of Tangled Web, Tales of Digital Crime from the Shadows of Cyberspace, a director of security for one of the world's largest accounting firms. He's appeared for his insight on all kinds of national television news and affair programs. Lately, he's been warning that global warming is a more serious national security threat than terrorism. Welcome to the program, Richard Power.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Well, Richard, how did climate change pop up on your radar as you assessed security threats?
You know, as you mentioned, I started out working on cybercrime issues, I would say, in the mid-90s when the World Wide Web sort of dawned as an opportunity, both in white hat and black hat minds. And I did a lot of work. I did an annual study with the FBI analyzing the impact of cybercrime on the U.S. businesses, state, local, federal governments, and universities. And the deeper I got into that study, I realized toward the late 90s that the high grade of that threat, for instance, the threats to infrastructure like the power grid or telecommunications system or the air traffic control system on the infrastructure attack side and on the economic espionage side, the potential for harming economic interests of a nation, that these high-grade threats were not taken as seriously as they should be, and I started to look deeper into them. And then I started to kind of look at the global economy in a different way and the World Wide Web in a different way. And if you could imagine in your mind seeing the World Wide Web as a circle and the global economy as a circle of the same size, and then you superimpose them on one another, it's really just one circle. In other words, it occurred to me it was all the same space. So the technological answers weren't enough. Information security ideas weren't enough to deal with these high-grade threats that we needed. Physical and personnel risk and security to be integrated with cybersecurity. And so I was looking at a bigger picture and looking at a national level and realizing that, you know, in the 21st century, national security and global security are really the same thing, because you can't have one without the other, because everybody's interconnected, whether they like it or not. So I was looking at this global continuum, if you will, of risk and security, and I've always personally been an environmentalist. I mean, in my personal life, you know, I draw great inspiration and great information from the wild places of the world and seek them out in my travels and everything else. And so I was aware of global warming, but I never looked at it in this context. And I realized in the late 90s, you know, that this should be the number one priority of anybody dealing with these issues for a people or for the planet as a whole. And that, just like the issues that I was trying to get my mind around in cybersecurity, it was not being dealt with as seriously as it should be. And then, so that was one of the first major twists for me in the road.
And why do you say that global warming is a bigger threat than terrorism? I mean, we have the Bush government and all of the cronies of it spending billions and billions on this and rearranging somewhat our society, but doing nothing about climate change.
Right. Well, it's madness. Where we just left off in the timeline there was right about 2000. And then skipping past the cybersecurity implications of the 2000 election, let's go to 9/11. Now, when 9/11 happened, people love to say the world changed on 9/11. Well, the world really didn't change on 9/11. Many people woke up to a dimension of the world that they were living in that they weren't previously aware of. Something's changed that didn't have to change, it shouldn't have changed. I changed personally, but not for the reason many people might think. I changed personally because I was just profoundly disturbed by how little had been done to prevent that from happening. And I was trying to get my mind around that and my knowledge of that and was, well, what is wrong with these people? And then the bigger question, what is wrong with this body politic and this society and this culture that people could let something like that happen and not have any accountability for it? But then, again, I looked at it in the context of climate change. Now, terrorism is something that can be dealt with. You know, it can have catastrophic implications. We've made the situation, by we, I mean, you know, us as a collective, have made the situation much worse than it had to be. yes, there's catastrophic implications, but they are there are things that can be done about them. There are things that can be done about global warming, but it is such a it is of a whole other magnitude of what can happen. I mean, what are the things they try to terrorize the populace with? The suitcase nuke and losing a city. Well, whether or not that ever happens, whether or not that could be prevented with, you know, sane policies and strong and healthy policies is one question. But if we don't do something about global warming, it won't just be one city or two cities or three cities or some limited thermonuclear war, which would be a catastrophe. It's a planetary catastrophe.
Yeah, we just about lost one city, New Orleans, already, and we think that was related to climate change.
Well, yeah, and I think you and I would be fairly confident. I remember about 2 years ago, I kind of broke with trying to get to address this issue with businesses and governments. But, you know, I would tell people in the people who were responsible for businesses and lives and in the Caribbean and the Gulf, I said, you know, let's talk about hurricane security. And they would say, well, we've been dealing with this for 18 years, 20 years. I said, not like this. That was 6 months before Katrina.
Yeah, well, you've brought up something that I wanted to talk to you about. If you give me just a second here,
sure.
I'd like to focus on a scenario developing out of so-called Hurricane Alley,
sure.
That path where ever larger superstorms
right.
swipe through the Caribbean. And the pictures of these storms from space, they're frightening. They're almost the size of small continents. Now, we know the last couple hit Central America and Mexico, but we're holding our breath for one of these monsters to slam into, well, say, the oil refiners of Houston.
Yes.
And you remember after a few big hurricanes a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk of people leaving Florida, and some people did.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, with added energy from the warming seas due to climate change, can you picture a scenario where big parts of the United States South become uninhabitable due to repeated hurricane damage?
I would say that is certainly a plausible scenario for instance, in the near future, for instance, the Gulf states. We've seen hurricanes in places that they weren't supposed to be, and they've never been before, like off the coast of Brazil. We know that we're going to be seeing them in the Mediterranean, et cetera, but where they hadn't been before. But I think in the Gulf, yes, I think that is a very plausible scenario. Now uninhabitable, you know, is another issue. I mean, if you're rich enough or poor enough, you can almost live anywhere. Because if you're poor enough, most people won't care where you live. And if you're rich enough, you know, you can deal with things. But I would think that it would certainly, that's a plausible scenario. A probable scenario would be that there will be significant economic impact on the Gulf region of the United States and on Caribbean, you know, basin because of such events in the near future.
Well, and then we look at the projection by the world's top scientists. Most of the countries around the equator, they say, are going to get hit very hard. Even countries with rainforest may dry out into grasslands, and some grasslands become deserts. So those experts predict that even by the middle of this century, huge migrations of people could head north.
Yes.
To the United States, when the U.S. South becomes one big dust bowl, maybe up to Canada. Is anybody really aware of the security implications of this? Who's looking at this?
There's what we can surmise, and there's what we can know from open source. The government of the United States is denying it, only begrudgingly now admits after 7 years, the evidence that its own scientists have put forth about the existence of global warming. So they're nowhere near coming to grips with these kinds of models that you and I and everybody who's awake are talking about. It always makes me laugh. In the United States right now, I don't know if you have the same issues currently in Canada, but, the immigration, illegal immigration is a hot-button issue they've decided in the United States. It always makes me laugh because, first of all, most of these people they want in here, and second of all, they never talk about outsourcing, which is where most of the decent jobs have gone. But illegal immigration, dear God, we are going to have climate refugees, not in the thousands or tens of thousands, but in the hundreds of thousands and tens of millions, conceivably, in different parts of the world, as you say, around the equator. No one is thinking about these things. Well, they may be thinking about these things under classified labels, but they're not speaking about them openly, no.
Well, the United Nations has put out various reports warning of hundreds of millions of refugees as the century progresses due to climate change.
Right.
And one of the guesses is that most of China will just migrate north into Russian Siberia.
Mm-hmm.
It will be more livable there due to climate change. But the geopolitical stresses and cracks and strains that could come out of this and the possible military actions are mind-boggling. I know the Pentagon did a report on this back in 2003. Let's see, it was called An Abrupt Climate Change Scenario and Its Implications for the United States National Security by Peter Schwartz and Doug Randall.
That's right.
But they were looking at the day-after scenario where the ocean circulation stops and Europe and North America goes cold.
Yes.
That did happen 8,200 years ago, where the whole northern hemisphere dropped by at least 5 degrees in less than 10 years. I'm also looking at scientists like Michael Oppenheimer and Sir James Lovelock, and both of them are asking whether there really is any upper ceiling to the heat
from human-based
global warming, you know. So we don't know. Are we? Even James Hansen warned this place could be
more like
Venus.
That's right.
What's your take? Are we worrying about a heat age or an ice age?
We don't know. I think Lovelock is very important. Whether you embrace his ideas or not, you have to come to grips with them. You have to deal with his ideas. And a lot of his ideas are very controversial, but they're very relevant, and you have to model that way. If you're really going to be responsible for people's safety, and for a way of life, you have to think about these things. You know, the more immediate issues are going to be, you know, desertification, deforestation, all those things, water, and ironically, many issues we were heading. And I know that you know this. We were heading toward a sustainability crisis, global sustainability crisis. Anyway, without global warming, we would have had issues about food, about water, about sanitation as the population climbs. Well, there's another issue, population. The governments of the world are in deep, from across the ideological spectrum, but particularly on the right, they are in deep denial about the changes that have to be made in order to sustain our way of life. It goes from the things we like to tell each other to do, you know, change the light bulbs and bring your cloth bag to the store. I'm not demeaning all of that. All that's very important. But the governments of the world have to listen to what the scientists are saying, what the UN is telling them, and they're just not. It's still business as usual.
Absolutely. I mean, at APEC, the biggest polluters who were there, you know, they agreed on aspirations, no set goals, and their big plan was, let's all plant more trees. Now, that sounds like a recipe for disaster to me.
Yeah, it's fantasy. It's not even fantasy, because I don't think they really don't believe it. It's a facade. And sometimes I wonder, are they banking on depopulation, you know?
Mm.
You know, are they banking on, well, you know, this will get rid of a lot of problems? I don't know, because it just doesn't make any sense. It's insanity. I hate to get political about this, but global warming was in the top five issues, national security issues, that a Gore administration would have been dealing with. I mean, that's at the national security level inside Washington in 2000. And we have lost 7 years. You know, you and I know Kyoto wasn't far enough, but dear God, I mean, at least it was an acknowledgement of the problem.
Yeah.
It was a beginning.
And those were maybe the 7 years where we tipped. But let's go to 2008.
Right.
We'll say that somebody sane makes it into the White House, and they call up Richard Power, among others, and say, well, what should we do? Have you got some advice for them?
This is one of the maddening things about this issue, and I'm sure you've observed it, and your listeners have observed it. I mean, the solutions are there. I always try to go back to try to look at it from human terms and kind of, you know, different terms. Like, you just stand in the midst of a city and look with, you know, beginner's mind, and you see everything that could go wrong if we don't do anything about climate change, and everything that we could do to make a difference. You know, every rooftop could be generating solar power. Every, you know, what would happen to a country if we said, as of this date, there will be no more cars sold in America that weren't hybrids or better. You know, there's all kinds of things that can be done. But what I would tell a sane person of whatever ideological bent that got into that position of power, what they have to do is make the psychological change in the leadership. Say, this is no longer business as usual. This is, our whole world is going to change, and the choice is remarkable, because the choice is, we can either make it much better, or it's going to get much worse. There's no in-between. Because if we do the things that we need to do for climate change, dear Lord, I mean, imagine if the United States of America wasn't obsessed with Middle Eastern oil, and vice versa, those in the Middle East of extreme and violent views weren't obsessed with our obsession with their oil. Imagine what all the geopolitical issues that you dealt with, that you alluded to, when we have these big population migrations. Imagine what the geopolitical diffusion that would happen if fossil fuel was not the most coveted resource on the planet. And I mean, my God, we're awash in sunlight. We're awash in wind.
And tidal power.
Exactly. And tidal power. Tidal power is a great example because it's so totally untapped. That's the thing. It's the leadership. You have to turn the switch inside yourself. We all have. Somebody has to stand up and say, we've got to do this. And not only do we have to do this, but it's going to be a so much better world if we do than this one. It's the irony, and I think you've touched on peak oil in your explorations as well, right?
Yes, I have.
So what an insane situation. Here we are fighting wars and proxy wars over a resource that is not only destroying our planet, but is going to run out. And again, goes to the cynical side about the ice melting. You think it hasn't occurred to Exxon that when that ice melts, they'll be able to drill for that oil?
Oh, they're already working on
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Of course
and,
they are.
And everybody claims they own it.
Everybody's planting flags up there and everything. This is the insanity of it. And they will, that's all right, we'll have nuclear power and air conditioning.
Well, let me tell you, when everybody comes up there for oil, we Canadians, we're going to kick you out because we have at least one icebreaker.
Well, good. I'm glad. I hope you get it. I hope you get there first. You are there.
Well, we're already making some of the world's dirtiest oil in the tar sands and making lots of money out of it. And
it's
terrible for us. Is there something you think we've missed that you think listeners need to know about?
We've touched on a lot of important things. And what I always try to leave people with is kind of the razor's edge, like in the Upanishads. It's walking. The path is walking the razor's edge. We want to wake people up. We want to impress upon them the seriousness of the situation. But at the same time, if you think about it without knowing how much could be done and how much better life could be if it were done, you know, it's easy to sink into, you know, some kind of doomsday thing or, the kind of fear propagation that we see with the issue of terrorism and stuff. So I always try to remember in my own communications and in talking to other people, you know, don't despair, because that's not what you want to communicate to people. We've tipped, but that doesn't mean, you know, it's over. And we can adapt. You know, we can still mitigate and we can still adapt. And if we do those things, we can be living in a much better world. But we also have to be ready, and then I'll shut up. We also have to be willing to see incredible changes, not in the climate, we know they're coming, in nature, we know they're coming, they're already upon us, but in our way of living and in our power structures.
And some of those things, as you say, are going to be good and enjoyable. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We've been speaking with Richard Power, a cyber threat and world security expert, who now thinks global warming is a bigger threat than terrorism. Richard, it has been a pleasure to meet you, and I hope you'll join us on another program.
I look forward to it. I just want to thank you for the important work you're doing. There's nothing more important than radio of this nature and streaming radio of this nature on the web. So, thank you.
Check out Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org.
From Radio EcoShock in 2007, that was threat analyst Richard Power. He was director of global security intelligence at Delwa Touche Tohmatsu, and after this interview, he was appointed distinguished fellow and SciLab director of strategic communications at Carnegie Mellon University. After 2015, Richard became a yoga teacher when he retired. You can find him on LinkedIn.
Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation. You know print media is floundering. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.
When you use a gallon of gasoline, you consume a gallon of gasoline, you add 5 pounds of carbon to the atmosphere. When I ask people this question in an audience, most people think it's just a minute amount, because it's very deceptive that carbon dioxide is an odorless, colorless gas. It's a gas, it floats. It doesn't seem like it has weight or mass. But most of a gallon of gasoline is carbon. It's a complex hydrocarbon. It weighs about 6 pounds. About 5 pounds of that is carbon. And all of that goes into the atmosphere. So just getting that sense of what's involved with a gallon of gasoline is important.
Just so you know, communication with scientists has iced over in recent weeks. It's hard to get in touch with anybody. It's fear. A French scientist arriving in Houston last week, representing the top science institute in his country, was investigated, and then they turned him back by the border authorities. They downloaded his phone, and they kept his laptop because they found criticism of the Trump administration cuts to science, and who isn't talking about that? Another American science conference is already advising burner phones for attendees. Abstracts for all presentations will not be published in advance as they usually are. It's a secret for those in the room. Underground science, that is where things stand in America. The radicalized FBI and the whole machinery of government is attacking scientists, individual scientists, and whole universities. Brainy heroes are the new villains, they say. By necessity, you will hear more voices from Europe and Australia on Radio EcoShock. Fortunately, we also have a full stock of over 1,000 interviews with top scientists and experts that have appeared on this program. I'm combing through those for voices we need to hear again. This is a good time for your listener suggestions. In these crazy days, while big systems shift, who do we need to hear? Send your ideas and guest suggestions by email to this address, radio@ecoshock.org. It's simple, radio@ecoshock.org. Or just send me an email to report local developments where you are. What are people saying? What is going on? We will get through this better together. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening, and yeah, keep caring about our world.
My life began in a car, so Dad tells me. Made my own kid there, I may die out on the road. When things get boring, I drive for something else. If it's no good here, I go there. I love to drive. Pickups, limousine, a truck, tractors, golf carts, you name it. If it's got a motor, that's good for me. The power.